stars, the patterns of cloud and light, the path of the birds, natural or artificial, the rain, the hail, the snow, and so forth. How does your building meet the sky? Since the difficulties insist on being recognized, in this case here, rain and snow, the response of the mediating technique, the roof, to such difficulties is to stand out. To stand out is to exist, and become the salient characteristic of the roof. While the effect of all the other aspects of the world that you want to be related to are diminished, and in many cases there is no response to the opportunities which they offer. 9 out of 10 builders deal with the rain and the snow, but not the moon. Some even deal with natural light as a physical light, not as a aesthetic light or a metaphysical light. Huh? So we're saying the physical world, if it's extreme, we know what to do. We have to respond to that. But there's lots of physical things, and for some reason, we choose to amplify some of the things. One's always looking, what is the determinant of form? If we have no clues from the world, you know, you have all these choices. If it's a tall building, you're going to do a structural problem. It's a big span, it's a structural problem. You're in the cold, it's cold. So we always do buildings about 4 or 6 stories high where there's nothing insists to be recognized except the social and cultural agenda. The civil and or cultural agenda of the society offers the second level of mediation. I'm still talking about technology by now. We expect different societies with different difficulties and facilities to build different mediators. We don't expect Eskimos to build Egyptian courtyard houses. It is where the different societies face similar difficulties with a different response that we discover some of the second level of mediation. We have two societies in different locations but with the same physical context, same available material, but they get different responses. Northern Americans, Northern Europeans, and Japanese all have chosen to make rain the major determinant of form in the design of a roof. All of them too, seek to control the pathway of the runoff. That is, in order to isolate it from the human realm. I don't want my rare books to get wet. The North Americans and Europeans take the runoff in as short a distance as possible. They have the three-dimensional rain. They put it onto a two-dimensional surface. Then they put it onto a one-dimensional line, and then they put it into a point, and then they put it around the back of the building, into the gutter and away, into the storm drain. Get it out of sight, out of my place. As if to isolate, not only spatially, but visually, the offending material from their touch and sight. Get that rain out of my sight, and away from me. The Japanese traditionally, I know we're all the same now, have isolated the runoff spatially, but amplified it visually as it cascades over the eaves of the roof. So they have three dimensions, two dimensions, and then a two-dimensional sheet onto that line. You're here. Remember Rashomon? Can even tell stories in the rain. The Japanese desire a more transparent relationship to the natural elements than do North Americans and Europeans. Hypothesis. Cultures have a range of phenomenological relationships to the world, and their degree of transparency or opacity influences their attitude to amplification and reduction. Cultures decide what the relationship is to the world. Are you interested in the path of the moon? No, we're having a hard time with the path of the sun. The third level of mediation, now I have this poor arc, this poor builder now, the physicality of the world doesn't say what you must do, and the social and cultural agenda gives you lots of alternatives. How do you choose? The third level of mediation leads to amplification of one aspect from the totality of possible experiences, and it derives from the intentionality of the designer and maker. As they used to say, the causa efficiens. Remember the formalis, firmalis, finalis, and causa. Unfortunately, in Firmness, Commodity, and Delight, the causa, man, the maker, was thrown out of that formula. So the causa efficiens comes back to us through the sciences as efficiency instead of making. The northerners, that's us, encounter with rain results in a limited set of architectural expressions. This is not true for the encounter with light. I'm just changing my cases. Where the roof is the mediator between the sun and the sky, the sun and sky as the source of light, and the interior as the receiver of illumination. If it were only the physics of general and task lighting that were to be answered to, then all roof shapes would be derived from the path of the sun and the human activity inside. The aesthetic preference of the culture and the individual decide what is the correct interplay of light among the solids and voids. There is less play in the metaphysical attitude where the order of the solids and voids is revealed through the positioning of light. I think I'll have to explain this. There is no separation among physics, aesthetics, and metaphysics in the poetics of Grosse Teste. You've probably read your Panofsky, Gothic Architecture and Scholasticism, where we have all these elements. We have the nave, the side aisle, the ambulatory, the chevet, the narthex, the chapels, the choir, all the things in plan. Then on section, you have the arcade, the tribune, the triforium, the clerestory. You have either your four or six-part vaulting, you have your flying buttress, you have your pinnacle. You know all the elements. So you've got them all. You've got your kit of parts. How do you combine them? Well, God is revealed to... We want this as a house to capture a god or a king. This one's to capture God. It's the dome later that captures the king. How can we capture him, her? You make the logic of the thing in the logic, his logic. And his logic is the logical concatenation of the parts. That every in the element, you see the whole. You remember that argument. I think of one case would be the Pilier Cantoni, multi-shafted column. Okay, well, that's obviously a Romanesque. Has to be. There's no cross-vaulting. There's cross-vaulting. Quadripartite, it's late French. Maybe some quadripartite here. Maybe it's English, it has lots of this stuff. That's because in the building site in England, the carpenter's important. On the building site in France, the mason's important. So they have domical masonry in the English of all this carpentry. And then, of course, because the thing is only a visual logic, not a structural logic, you make it rotationally or you make it symmetric. You know that. What you do is you're supposed to be able to touch the whole thing by touching the part. So God is pleased. So he comes in, so you got him. Then somebody else says, no, that's not how you get God. God, there's a logical hierarchy based on how things partake of light. The hierarchy, yeah? So Grosse Teste says, remember, Grosse Teste is the one who influences Thierry of Chartres, who influences the design of Chartres. Light is the principle of order and value, and the objective value of a thing is determined by the degree to which it partakes of light. Nothing to do with lumens or foot candles. And even that light itself was the highest mediator since, quote, light is the mediator between bodiless and bodily substances. So what he does is he takes the four-layered cathedral, makes it a two-layered cathedral, gets rid of the tribune, the thing that hides the side roof, over the side aisles, and he builds into the clerestory, the triforium. So you now have a two-layered cathedral with three pieces. It's not very bright. In fact, I think it's damn dark inside Chartres. It's nothing to do with that. It's the logic. It has to do with a metaphysical light. It's not Le Corbusier's aesthetic light. It's not Lucan's light. The range of interpretations of the mediating effect of light and one of its techniques, the roof, ensure that what is amplified is the intention of the designer. So, Lucan's buildings, how do they meet the sky? Homogeneous. He pre-stresses the light. He gives it no directionality. He wants a homogeneous light. All his tiles dimensions are related to a door dimension, which is obviously related to a corridor dimension, which is obviously related to a window dimension, which is obviously related to a number of windows in a corridor between columns. Columns don't just have to do with gravity, they have to do with everything else. So Kahn has everything locked in. He's not going to have lots of light and then little light. He's going to destroy all of that hierarchical locking. So he has homogeneous light to get his silence. There is no drama, just silence. Le Corbusier says, no, light, dark, light, dark. So we'll look at Le Corbusier's roof lines. It's nothing to do with the path of the sun. It's modified by that. The decision is not made on the quantity or quality of sun. It's not made by the civil or cultural agenda. It's made by the intentionality of the architect with respect to light and place. A resulting characteristic from this is drama. Through amplification, something is made to stand out. Whether it be in response to the physicality of the natural world, the cultural agenda, or it could be the social, it could be a capital-intensive versus a labor-intensive economy. Mies van der Rohe shifting from labor-intensive to capital-intensive, so out goes the manual tactility and in comes a visual tactility, albeit done in method. Certain aspects of the world stand out, that is to say that techniques, and technology offer up a drama, and our perception converts the world into a spectacle made dramatic through our mediation. The original questioning of the conditions and circumstances that lead to the characteristics of the mediation might be rephrased as, what is the script for this spectacle that man the builder is providing? Really, builders are Maxwell's demons. They're trying to bring order where everyone else wants to bring disorder. In the physical world. When the context of the physicality of the natural world or the cultural agenda specifies what needs to be amplified and what reduced. If these two people tell you what to do, either the world or the other people, and you're going to build, the techniques, and technology are considered appropriate. They are suitable. They're proper, they're belonging, it comes from propriari, is near. You bring things near to you, from the world, from the culture. So appropriate technology is satisfying these. In the absence of clues as to what is appropriate, the builder appropriates, means takes possession of the world. And that comes from a different root. It's from proprius, meaning own or self. They appropriate a text from out of the context of the world. That is, the builder's intentionality abstracts through amplification and reduction and presents finally an interpretation of aspects of the world. So there's a difference between appropriate technology, appropriateness, and appropriation. Not all human intentionality is accompanied by intuitive perception or poesis. Many humans follow the path of Narcissus, from narcosis meaning numbness, whom McLuhan says saw the extension of himself in the mirror. And since that time, man at once became fascinated by any extension of themselves in any material other than themselves. These extensions are amputations or isolation of a sense through amplification, leading to a blocking of perception and a condition where man is fragmented by his technologies. Or, quote, men have become what they have beheld. The danger from forgetting the reductive effect of mediation. All of these things are mediation, and you're reducing the world through the mediation. The danger from the reductive effect of mediation lies not only in the fragmentation of living, fragmentation of perception, but also the danger lies in the emphasis given to the amplifications. These abstracted texts, which man the builder provides, delivered through mediation, seem to be more precise, even perfect. And quoting Don Eide, the temptation is to take the new features as more real than those features which have to do with the world, than those features which are worldly, are mundial, are mundane. That means those features revealed by ordinary perception. So if we make the abstraction, we organize it, we say it is precise and it is perfect and it's higher in the pecking order than the worldly things which are now mundane. And you know how mundane as a word has been devalued. Now I have some real problems. Also, these abstracted texts or amplifications or remains can be organized and even codified into a language. That's where topology and morphology is going to lead us. A language which has silenced the remainder of perception, because it highlights something, but it hides other things. It silences the remainder of perception, and the language was codified for another perception, another country, another time, another condition. Greece is not Scotland. Some of my colleagues who were born in New Jersey are in love with Greece and Rome and the Renaissance and McKim, Mead and White, and they have absolutely no time for my interests, which are Northern European, and Gothic, in fact, is still vulgar to them. And I have nothing to do with Greece and Rome. I'm surrounded by it, but the banks have taken over anyway. Another danger lies, as Habermas pointed out, in the separation of the layman from the literati. The layman experiences only the mundane. The builder, who knows the codified language, transforms reality and represents a text. The logic and validity of that text is accessible only to those who speak or read the unembodied language. I think they call it architect for architect's sake. Architect for architect's sake. So if you have not read Palladio, stay indoors. There's lots of other characteristics I would like to have investigated, but you've been patient. I just end with saying what the things I would like to investigate some other time. The informing response says in part, the informing response I set out at the beginning of the evening to look for, I have found no answers for it, but I think I understand something's going on out there. I've worked out something's going round something. You saw the New Yorker cartoon. In part, the informing response that I found says that changes in the form of our perception are a result of transparency and opacity, amplification and reduction, appropriateness and appropriation, lay and literate knowledge, codification of languages. Other things, the other questions would lead to considerations of extensions of experience, where these things, new aspects of the world are presented to you that have never been experienced before. And they will never be experienced unless you have the way to go out there. Transformation of experience, where the world is presented in a new way. I think computer graphics, who knows? Maybe just a different hammer will do. The characteristics of style and its relation to the speed of production As you change the speed of production, you're going to change the style of your architecture. The effect of spatializing as a result of the division of labor. I'm thinking on the building site. The deconstruction and the reconstruction of space and time. Telephoto lens, it's easy in the movie business or in the still business, but now I'm beginning to understand Frank Furness now. They have these little short fat columns, which I thought maybe he was a monster, and the capital nearly rips your eye out as you're walking past into the library, and then I realize that what he's doing is he's giving me a close-up. What I have to do is when I get into his buildings, I have to put this opposite of the telephone. I have to put things in their place. I expect the cap to be up there somewhere, not down here. And I think mannerism is a little bit of a camera. But there's the reconstruction of space and time, too. Architects are really not dealing with that too much just now. I think the movie people are in better shape, different medium, and so forth. I'd like to end by saying we find an adequate summary in response to our question in Walter Benjamin's statement. Quote, "Evidently, a different nature opens itself, if only because an unconsciously penetrated space is substituted for a space consciously explored." Okay. Do you have time to watch a few slides, 5:45, or it's too late? I brought... Is that where we're leaving? We had related these to the talk with the increasing opacity. Does it come from making things as a craftsman, or does it come from a theory of structures? There's a whole series of slides there which you would have seen. This one, as you remember, the different color paint of the different strength stress in the material. The higher stress, red is high stress, blue is the next. I have some of the Hancock too. So, are we now answering to the theory determining the form? But it does look superficially like this, but you know damn well it's nothing to do with it. Okay, let's move on. And transparency and opacity, where the complete opacity of the production method is the major determinant of form. Is there any way of stopping them going too fast? Okay, what is transparent and what is opaque in the Parthenon? It's not visual. Let's move on. Here we have in Chaux de Fonde on the left, Le Corbusier's early work, which is very transparent, deals with the physicality of the world. The roof wants to recognize the rain, and the ground wants to recognize the ground. This is before he had to leave town. And these are houses adjacent to it, where someone thought they were in another setting. They thought they were copying Le Corbusier. They're copying a later Le Corbusier, but in the setting of the rain and the snow and what have you in Chaux de Fonde in Switzerland. But they're out of... This is Le Corbusier responding to the physicality of the world and the kind of transparency you read the place in the building. Next slide. And this is a view from my office window here. Well, no, I'm actually above it. We went down to take a photograph. Here's an architect obsessed by rain. And you see the copper color is rain. I should have you, there's the drains and everything. It's all hidden when it gets down to our level. And then all those beautiful gargoyles, which you think maybe think that Gothic. He's obsessed by rain. They don't work. It's an obsession with rain in Philadelphia. And here is another obsession with rain, but what I want to show you here was the overhang on the right, where the Japanese make the two-dimensionality, and then they have this collecting line on the ground here. And then the nice detail, I don't know how you do it in Cornell, but up on the other roof, it comes along the edge, it goes along a gutter, which is unusual, and at the end of the gutter, you see the little cantilever there? It drops through a little hole in the gutter into a stone. He's not doing it as a surface, but as a point in the sun and saying, this rain thing, let's do something. Let's remind ourselves of a relationship to it. Next slide. This is a physical light here. And here is light, this is more like Lucan's light, where the structure is giving you the pattern. And it's still a physical light, but it gets involved in the order of the building. Next one. And this one is tending towards a aesthetic light. And here we have the metaphysical light, the idea of the metaphysical light. Next one. How does your building meet the sky? Mr. Kahn, Mr. Le Corbusier. Why don't you choose any of their buildings? Not choose two or three in case you choose deliberately choose ones that destroy my hypothesis. Okay, homogeneous. The site doesn't tell you. The culture doesn't tell you. The intention. And let's see the inside of these two buildings. Oh, it might be better if we had the lights out, but here we have a rather homogeneous light. Ah, the buildings look better in the dark. And here we have Le Corbusier with his dramatic light. He is dramatic. Next slide. How does your building meet the sky? How does it meet the ground? Look at Le Corbusier meets the sky better than it meets the ground. Path of the sun, the stars. What about the birds? The treetops. Next slide. This is for the Walter Benjamin talk. And this is, what's his name? Camera Works, David Hockney. His studies on the perception of space using the Polaroid. But this is how he experiences the Brooklyn Bridge. And let's move on. I just wanted you to have some pictures. Here we are, building supernature on top of nature, and here we have supernature on top of a pre-existing supernature. Next slide. How do you perceive the world? Are you in reflection, or are you just at a cocktail party? Next slide. Here's I think this is near the end. A friend and myself, we have become completely ossified. We're totally in frame. We have all these intellectual frameworks about the world. So we're stone and we observe the world. But we're stone ourselves. We can't change. And here is a problem here. How do you perceive a column? Is it transparent to be human, to relate it to human scale? Or should the column be related to Euler's buckling equation? How do you get the proportion of a column now? No one seems to know. Obviously, that would not stand up with those three little things, and it apparently had difficulty standing up with the ladies too. Over a period. Next slide. And I just end with that one. I see this is the condition we're heading towards. That's my friend and I. We originally went out and became ossified, and now we are back to the natural world, and we're both machines. Because we have too many intellectual frameworks. That's all of the slides. They are related to the text, but we've been very patient. Thank you. Please? Oh. Yes, the brief essay would be, a brief description would be, someone who was trained, who was influenced by stonemasonry. And a transparent relationship to the material, as transparent as one would be able to with those techniques and those material. He, if we leave aside his brick period for a minute, and think of his early attempts to use metal, what he does is he takes a material which is manufactured in a, by his time, by the rolling mill. It's no longer the strips of wrought iron hammered by hand, so you have all these leather straps, so you can make Art Nouveau out of it. I mean, Art Nouveau and wrought iron go hand in glove, huh? So what he does is he has something which is rolled, and then there's a difficulty in showing any transparent relationship to it, because the process of production is so opaque itself. You remember Macintosh's beams, where he takes the eye section and he takes the end of it and he rips the flanges? He tears a flange and goes, and he puts a wooden beam there. You know, all those happy little Scotsmen cutting the beams there? You try and do that now. So there's a sort of, when wrought iron, late 19th century, just before Bessemer and Siemens and Martin and Mushet have all the power, there's still some architects, late Labruste in the Bibliothèque Nationale, early Macintosh, doing things that the industry is saying, you can't do, we're too opaque for that. So Mies is struggling with that. He's coming from something where he does have some control. He moves to metal where he's less control. So what did he do? He cuts it. And then he rewelds it. So you have all these labor-intensive sections. Huh? It's a hell of a rolling mill, it'll turn that out. Huh? And you can't extrude it either, because steel is difficult to extrude. So he's trying to show the presence of the fabrication, but in a material that doesn't lend itself to that. He can get away with that because at that time in Europe, it is an economy where in the formula of capital, labor, and energy, labor costs less than capital. Costs less than the machines to make it and the material itself. That's why Europeans have been often obsessed by efficiency. They're only not obsessed by efficiency when they have colonies to exploit. It's getting difficult for everybody now. He comes to America where, for historical reasons, there's a shortage of labor. So a lot of the processes of production optimize or cut down on labor. He comes to capital intensive. Except every time I see a bus, I think there's at least three buses there. Yeah? When you see those joints, wow, I can see somebody in the Soviet Union carving all the material out, and then you have this waste which you don't know what to do with. So he comes to America with a labor-saving, capital-intensive economy. So he can't do that. He can't do as much of this anymore. So he has to use rolled sections, which have to be fire protected. And you stick that on. It's no longer a transparency to do with the hand. It's a transparency to do with the eye. He's now being influenced by, Tom's not old enough, but it was at his school, by Semper's notions of, you know, the visual tactility of weaving. Hmm? And you think of fabric, you think of the history of making things. So Mies shifts from an actual manual tactility to a visual tactility. And then it gets to be... It doesn't match his original intention, and I'm sure he knew it. Like Kahn has problems too when he's working with concrete and light and structure they don't always get their intention, but sometimes they like the thing that they get out of it. So that was the shift from capital saving to a capital intensive economy, which runs parallel with a shift from a manual transparency to a visual transparency.